Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to ID the Future. My name is Jay Richards. I'm the Director of Research here at the Center for Science and Culture at the Discovery Institute, and we're here in the Discovery Institute offices in Seattle. Today I'm sitting here with Anne Gager, who's a Senior Research Scientist at Biologic Institute, also in the Seattle area, and we're going to talk to Anne about a new article that she has just out in the new online journal Biocomplexity. Anne, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Yeah, we're going to talk about this research paper that I know is a product of several years of research. Mm-hmm. It's called Reductive Evolution Can Prevent Populations from Taking Simple Adaptive Paths. That is descriptive, but I want to sort of unpack this a little bit for listeners. But tell me a little bit about the co-authors. I noticed you have three other co-authors, especially Ralph Silke. Tell me a little about that.
Ralph started this project several years ago in his lab at the University of Wisconsin-Superior. And then after a while, we started to collaborate with him in some of the experiments. It's turned out to be a really interesting project, it surprised us, let me put it that way, the way the results turned out.
Well, what were the experiments specifically that you did?
Ralph set out to ask a question about how easy it is for evolution to accomplish certain tasks. And so he developed a system where the biological question was, can bacteria evolve the ability to make a protein that's broken, an enzyme, to fix a broken enzyme?
Right.
And this enzyme is broken in two steps, two mutations. If you fix one mutation, the enzyme starts to work, but very poorly, and it then is capable of fixing the second mutation. And once it's done that, it's a fully functional enzyme. It should give the bacteria a significant growth advantage compared to bacteria with a broken enzyme.
Okay.
So that's what's meant by an adaptive path.
Mm-hmm.
It's a path that should be possible for evolution to accomplish, because the first step, once you make it, you have a slight advantage over the other cells in the population. And then the second step gives you a huge advantage, so it's called an adaptive path.
Oh, I see. So it's basically, according to the Darwinian story here, you're going to have a system, and if you have a mutation that happens to be adaptive, then natural selection can preserve that in a population. And so this is basically testing either the extent, the competence, or the limits of this Darwinian mechanism to produce new things.
Now, a two-step adaptive path, where each step is selectively beneficial, adaptive, should be within easy reach of a bacterial population.
Okay.
The wrinkle is, the way we set up the system, the enzyme that's supposed to be corrected in evolution is on a little ring of DNA outside the chromosome called plasmid, and there's lots of that plasmid in the cell, and the plasmid churns out lots of protein, but the protein is broken.
Okay.
So since it's making useless broken protein, that carries a cost for the cell. It uses energy to make that protein.
So there's a trade-off.
Okay. There's two choices the cell can make. It can either go through the adaptive path and repair the protein, or it can shut off the useless expression of that protein.
Okay.
If it shuts off the useless expression, it has a selective advantage because it's more metabolically efficient than the neighboring cells in the environment. And so those cells will grow better. They'll divide faster. They'll overtake the population. So the question is, when you have cells in a selective environment, they don't have a lot of the nutrients they need. They're competing for nutrients. They lack the ability to make tryptophan, and we only give them a teeny bit of this amino acid tryptophan.
Okay.
Tryptophan's what the broken enzyme is supposed to be able to help them to make.
Right.
So you grow them in long-term culture, in limiting amounts of tryptophan. And then you ask the question simply, what happens?
Right. So what did happen?
It was a surprise to us. It took us a while. What we found out is that the cells never took the path to full function. They never evolved the full function. That was a complete surprise, and we had to do some head scratching and then some experiments to figure out what was happening.
Well, what is going on here then? Because this, you know, it seems, even if you maybe you're skeptical of some of the grander Darwinian claims, this doesn't seem like it'd be that big a deal. So this is obviously, as you said, a surprise. What did you discover was going on?
We found out that almost exclusively, they always turned off the overexpressing genes. They turned off the production of that broken protein.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened within 30 to 50 generations. And it happened multiple ways, because there are many ways to break a gene, right, many ways to turn off expression. We did this in 14 different cultures. Sometimes they deleted the gene.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they inserted extra DNA that turned off the gene.
Right.
Sometimes they had point mutations that turned off the gene. All 14 cultures eliminated expression of the broken gene.
So you're testing this in sort of different scenarios to see if maybe get changed the circumstances a little bit, maybe it eventually find the pathway.
We tried it in liquid culture,
mm-hmm.
In serial liquid culture. We tried it in batch culture, where we have billions of cells,
right?
Almost billions, 10 to the 8 cells, mm-hmm. starting in a culture per milliliter of culture. We tried it on solid culture. We screened a total of 10 to the 12th cells. Now, what does that mean? It's a 10 with 12 zeros after
it. A bunch.
Okay. A trillion cells. And what did we find? Only one case did the cells ever make the first step on that adaptive path. And we think it happened on an auger plate.
Okay.
One out of 10 to the 12 cells made the change.
Right.
The first step, but never made it to the second step.
And obviously you're dealing with organisms with reproduction rates that are very high.
Very high.
If you've got sort of trouble with these Darwinian pathways here, you know, as philosophers say, a fortiori, you're probably going to have more serious problems with, well, with the different organisms.
At a minimum, the normal rate at which these cells can revert these specific mutations is on the order of 1 in 10 to the 8 cells will revert.
Okay.
This is the first step.
Right.
So the cost of this overexpression is enough to knock back their ability to revert 4 orders of magnitude.
So a huge disincentive.
Huge distance.
Okay.
What we think is happening is that you start with a population of cells. They all carry the two mutations.
Mm-hmm.
And the first cell that evolves a way to eliminate that expression has a significant growth advantage. We measured the growth rates of these different scenarios, these different cells of these different types,
mm-hmm.
and any mutation that knocks down the expression of the useless protein gives a significant growth advantage. Those cells overtake the culture.
Okay.
Once you eliminate expression, there's no way for the cell to selectively improve the broken protein, because it's mm-hmm. not being made.
Wow.
So it's a dead end.
Right. Well, so what would you say? I mean, this is obviously a very specific experiment, I guess, with E. coli,
yep.
right, with some bacteria. But if you know somebody asks you, well, so what? What are the sort of wider theoretical implications of this work?
Okay. It's an active topic of debate among evolutionary biologists right now. How many adaptive steps are within reach for an mm-hmm. organism before a selective benefit is achieved?
Right. Are there a lot of steps, or do we have this gradual pathway, which is sort of what the Darwinian mechanism would require?
The consensus has been you can accomplish maybe 2 or 3 steps without any selective benefit.
Okay.
And then you got to start getting some advantage.
The probabilistic hurdles are just too high. You don't have natural selection saying, well, I'll get 6 mutations one after the other. Eventually, I'll get a function
but
that needs one.
Everybody assumes if you have an adaptive path where every step is selectively advantaged, then it's going to happen.
That's
it's automatic.
Right, that's best case scenario, cumulative complexity.
What our paper shows is that if in order to get that advantage you have to highly express the protein,
mm-hmm.
then the cost of expression itself may be high enough to prevent the adaptive path from being followed.
Even in these very first steps.
Even in the very first steps. Now, that's significant because a lot of research, protein evolution research,
mm-hmm.
is based on the idea that you can recruit enzymes to new functions by following these simple adaptive paths. And most of the experiments that test this idea called gene recruitment, use plasmids in cells that are multi-copy plasmids with extra ramped up expression of the proteins they're testing.
Right.
They start with a protein, an enzyme with very poor function, and the only reason it can rescue is because it's overexpressed vastly on the same level as the proteins we were testing here. The difference is they do their experiments under conditions where the expression of the poorly functioning enzyme is absolutely required.
Mm-hmm.
We argue in our paper that that's not a realistic scenario because in the wild, first of all, selection is rarely absolute.
Right.
Second, we show in our paper that the cost of expression is enough for the cell to choose to...
This trade-off moves them in the other direction from the
to eliminate
expectation.
In which case, the chances of an enzyme being recruited to a new function are reduced.
Okay.
So
the sort of layman's implication here is that at least when we're looking at the empirical data in this area, the theoretical expectations for the Darwinian mechanism may be vastly oversold, it sounds to me.
Vastly oversold needs to be carefully considered. When people write papers, they should think about whether what they're proposing is a realistic scenario or is it just simply a lab-based experiment. If it works in the lab, would it work in the wild?
Because obviously a lab-based experiment, you want to replicate the sort of wild, real-world scenarios. Otherwise, you've intervened with the intelligent design of the experiments.
That's right.
And it might not necessarily tell you what the world is like. Well, this is terrific. Thank you, Anne. We're going to put up the paper, the link to the paper, at ID the Future, but you can go to it directly at bio-complexity.org. You can learn more about Anne Gager, senior research scientist at Biologic Institute, at biologicinstitute.org. Anne Gager, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Again, this is Jay Richards, the Director of Research at the Center for Science and Culture at Discovery Institute, and thank you for joining us on ID the Future.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2010. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.